Hello, everybody, and welcome to Mormon Sex Info. This is Natasha Helfer, and I am super excited to have my guest with me today, Kyle Ashworth. He's the host of Latter-day Stories. And what was really interesting for me is that, Kyle, you came out to Wichita, Kansas as part of my, I don't know what to call it, my disciplinary council, right? It should have been a more joyful way of meeting each other, but it was not. So anyway, I'm really excited to talk to you about that experience. But before that, I would just like for you to introduce yourself. Like, I don't know much about you, just your personal life and kind of, I'm guessing Latter-day Stories is kind of like a thing you do on the side, aside from maybe a professional career, et cetera.
Yeah, if anyone knows this space well enough, you know that it is a side opportunity that takes all of your time full time. So gladly do it, but you're not in Kansas anymore, Toto. So welcome back to
Thank you.
The great state of Utah.
I'm in the salt and the elevated salty spaces.
Hallelujah. I'd rather be here. But no, thank you for giving me an opportunity to discuss such an interesting experience. A little background. I am the host of the Latter-day Stories podcast. It originally actually was the Gay Mormon Stories podcast under the Open Stories Foundation. So it was the one of the podcasts that John DeLynn started years ago in 2012, essentially just giving space to all of those stories that weren't necessarily Mormon stories, but specifically gay Mormon stories. And they ran that podcast until 2016. And then it just kind of sat idle after Daniel Parkinson kind of set it on the shelf. And I begged John to revamp it and bring it back to life. And that didn't happen. And I begged again and it didn't happen. And so finally, I got him captive one day and we went through all the pros and cons. And he said, you know what? It's yours. Run with it and see what you can make of it. So I picked up the Latter-day Stories podcast in 2017 or 18 and launched it for its seventh season. And so we've been, it's been Latter-day Stories for the seventh, eighth, and ninth. And we're in our ninth season now, which is the longest running podcast in the space. So we're out there hunting down those who are finding themselves at the intersection of sexuality and reality, which is also your space, but at the LGBTQ street and LDS Avenue, which is also an interesting space. And when we talk about minorities or marginalized, we are a minority within a minority within a minority in this space. So interestingly enough, though, our audience is large. Our episodes will get between 10 and 20,000 people who visit. The Facebook group is as large as Mormons Building Bridges or some of these other groups. So I don't know 20 or 30,000 gay Mormons or people with an intersection that intersects here, but they're out there because they're eating up the content and they're participating in the event. So I think that this topic impacts more people than we know. So professionally, I own a real estate development firm. I develop commercial, industrial, and multifamily real estate. That's my side hobby. My real goals in life are helping people to really, I mean, in terms of the podcast and in terms of my personal life, which it does kind of stretch over into my professional world, is helping people become better people based on their circumstances and helping people know that they're not alone, they're not broken, and that their best days are ahead. And I think that's some of my most fulfilling work in what I do. I guess really what I do professionally and what I do with the podcast really are very, very similar. You take something that seems bare and unwanted and mm-hmm. turn it into something that people want to be around and want to use and want to be seen with. So that's just a little bit about what I do professionally. I'm gay. I was married to a woman in a mixed orientation marriage, unbeknownst to her. In 2006, I came out, forced free agency. She forced me out of the closet. Mm. We did divorce amicably about a year after that. We have four kids that we co-parent together. She's remarried. I'm in a relationship. And we have two homes and one family. So we still are super good friends. In fact, probably better friends today than we were while we were married. and our kids benefit from that, and our relationship is really solid. So no complaints in that department, and this is a great life. This is all the things that I didn't think I could ever achieve or expect to achieve. So that's a little bit of a 30,000 foot view.
No, that's great. That's great. And your relationship with the church then, have you kind of gone by the wayside in the sense of inactivity? How do you want to describe maybe your relationship currently with the LDS church?
Yeah, I resigned from the church in 2018. Mm-hmm. So I've been out for a little bit, and I was the white picket. We had the white picket form Mormon fence life, white picket fence, Mormon life.
Yeah.
we did it all. I served in leadership callings and served a mission, went to the temple, married in the temple. We did all the things, that were necessary. But at some point, the reality, sexuality, hysterosity, all those things collide one day, and you start panning through to determine exactly what it is that really brings you joy in your life and what it is and what in life is fulfilling. And when you get to that intersection, it's interesting that I kind of look at it like a church itself. The overall view of the church is what you can see from the top down. But when you start disassembling everything from the steeple to the roof and to the classrooms, to the eventually getting all the way to the foundation, sometimes it's necessary to rip it all out and start all over again. So I ripped it all out and I'm slowly rebuilding.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. So, and then on your podcast then, is it mainly you interviewing other people anywhere kind of in the LGBTQ plus spectrum as far as allowing them to tell their stories, or do you have professionals on? Like, what exactly do you cover mostly on your podcast?
Yes and yes and yes. The purpose of the podcast really is to bring visibility to this topic. Clearly, there's an opportunity for people to share their stories, exactly where they're at today. And that was one aspect of the Gay Mormon Stories podcast that really meant a lot to me. I remember just sitting in the bathtub with my headphones on, sometimes just bawling my eyes out because people were sharing these stories that were heartbreaking, but also heartfelt and success stories that I knew would never happen to me because it would require me to come out. So those stories are vitally important because it shares the human side of the topic, this intersection, the LGBTQ experience is so profound in so many reasons, in so many ways, but yet so many people aren't interested in it because it doesn't impact them directly, or at least they don't believe it impacts them directly. And so there was that aspect of the podcast that is really vibrant, but there's also the data-driven and educational side of it. Some people want the data, they want the research. And so I've had great guests on like Bryce Cook and Greg Prince that we sit down and analyze some of the really interesting, fascinating parts, the scientific parts of sexuality and church history as well, and trying to break this down and understand the tradition and why some Mormons act the way they do and why some leaders do what they do in terms of this space. And then another aspect of that is then bringing in the mothers, the wives in mixed orientation marriages to share their stories. I really like, I mean, it's multifaceted, but there were some famous gay Mormons like the Josh and Lolly Weeds, the Montgomerys. I mean, just a lot of families that had prominent Mormon stories. Their stories came and then they went, and sometimes people wondered what happened to them. Former North Star presidents who just vowed lives of celibacy, and I'm now interviewing them with their husbands. People who are on the Mormon and Gay website who said my life will be single and celibate forever, who are now married to their beautiful husbands and wives. So I do a lot of those follow-up stories as well. The where are they now? That yeah. gives people an opportunity to see that this is a very progressive and open and fluid experience for everyone, and that the worst thing we can really do is put everyone in a box and restrict them to what their experience was 2 years ago, but prove that life does go on. So that's kind of the three-ring circus of the Latter Gay Stories podcast, but it is all about normalizing this topic, making it visible. Every week we have a coming out story that's published. Every week we have a I call them the get to know yous, but a very candid written opportunity to learn about someone's story. Every 7 to 10 days, we have a video episode, video and audio podcast. And then twice a week, we have a quirky little meme that comes out on our Facebook or Instagram page that just gets people to think about this topic. And I usually relate that back to Mormonism somehow, usually using Mormonism against Mormonism to help show that this topic isn't as taboo as we at once believed it should be or could be.
Right. Oh, that's amazing. I didn't realize that you were doing so much on a regular basis. So I'm going to have to definitely dive into your stuff for sure. So have you had any interactions with the church officially as far as them being upset or trying to shut down your podcast or retribution to any of your guests? Or since you've resigned, it's kind of like a no relationship type of status?
Yeah, that's a really great question. The short answer is yes. The long answer is I've resigned from the church. So I don't know how much of a target I am, other than they do combat the message every now and then. About a year ago, I produced a document called On the Record. It's a publication that studied the messaging that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints has put out regarding gender identity and sexual orientation from Joseph Smith forward. And it ended up becoming a kind of a viral sensation in this space. It's 80 pages of talks, leaked video, audio, behind closed doors discussion that all is directly linked back to LDS.org or Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.org or whatever the new URL is. But so when I published On the Record, there was definitely buzz in the community, especially in Mormondom, because this was putting them on the record. I just remember when the church was so heavily involved in Evergreen, which for those who aren't familiar with Evergreen, this was the church's quasi support group for gay Latter-day Saints. It was essentially their vehicle for ensuring that conversion therapy could stay alive and the processes by which they determined were healthy to invite people into mixed orientation marriages or help them overcome their sexuality via programs like healthy touch and cuddling and just a wide variety of unhealthy practices that didn't lead to people undoing their sexuality. But the messages that always came from these Evergreen, which eventually morphed into North Star, which is currently the church isn't holding hands with North Star, but yet supportive of the group. And likewise, North Star affirms the messages of the church. But the message coming out of both of those organizations was the church has been very favorable to LGBTQ Latter-day Saints, that we've shown only nothing but love and empathy. But On the Record shows that it's quite a different story from George Q. Cannon in 1897, who said, I bear apostolic witness that the very best way of dealing with the gay people among our society, the perverse among our society, is to, A, if the saints will have faith, God will murder them from Zion and remove them from us on his own. It was a test of faith to the saints. And when these gay people didn't end up dying via plague or lightning bolt, it was easy to go back to the saints and say, clearly you weren't living religious law or had enough faith because they still roam among us. So we go from George Q. Cannon forward to there's so much history in this space, but the church creating investigative arms that would root out homosexuals in Utah and Idaho. They were using the Salt Lake City police chief. They were using district courts. They were using bishops and stake presidents to report this to Ernest Wilkinson at BYU, saying that we will admit no homosexual to BYU. If you feel like you swing this way, this is part of your orientation, we invite you to let it be known. We'll reimburse your tuition. We don't want to be contaminated by your presence. To the Dallin H. Oaks era of BYU that led to the aversion therapy, the shock therapy, where there were methods to try to change these people and reorient their sexuality. To the Spencer W. Kimball era. I mean, we just continue to go on and dig in. So I know what your original question was. I haven't forgot it.
Fascinating. I love that you're walking us through this history. It's very important for us to realize.
And it it digs deeper. We could have a whole podcast on just the Dallin H. Oaks era and why he's so homophobic and why he's spent so much time in the space. And it is because he worked under Spencer Kimball and worked under these at the time, the apostles who charged him with better understanding this. And through the legal system, the ways the church could legally root out these gay members of their society. But Dallin Oaks, for example, spent 40, nearly 50 years in this space, and he's lost 100% of his cases, his amicus briefs, his friends of the court. When it comes to this topic, everything the church has saddled their horse to or hooked their wagon to has been overturned either by a Supreme Court, a district court, a federal court, or the public itself. And this has been a losing battle for the church at every corner, but yet their message remains consistent and the same. So that's what On the Record really does. Is it just goes through a historical and chronological record of what the church has done in this space. So your original question is any pushback? This is a twofold answer. One, because in my professional career as a real estate developer, I have been able to make inroads and friends with people who are now in the 70 and general authorities that we worked with. That is an interesting space to be in, knowing that they know me and I know them. And I also know that some of their children identify along the spectrum. So there is this nuanced experience for those people who understand and spend a little time in the space. So yes, I have had contact with general authorities. There are apostles with gay children, gay grandchildren, gay brothers. So this isn't a completely foreign space to the general authorities, to the presidents of the 70, to the members of the multiple quorums of 70. This becomes even closer and more intimate as their family members also identify. So yes, that discussion has happened. Now, in terms of retribution to guests, and I brought up On the Record for a reason. One of the stories that we focus on the Record is the therapist, Alan Bergen. And you might be familiar with that name. Alan Bergen was a therapist at BYU that was brought in to essentially craft the aversion therapy program with Dean Byrd. These two worked at BYU under the direction of Dallin Oaks, who was then the former the current president of BYU. And they created what was the church's hallmark aversion therapy program, ridding all the homosexuals of their evil, deviant, contagious desires, their masturbatory bestiality experiences that Spencer Kimball had created the narrative around. Right. So Alan Bergen and Byrd get together and form this program within the psychology department at BYU, which is difficult. And the On the Record side of this was really deep. And it took a lot of effort to root so much of this story out. But when I published On the Record, about a month and a half after I published it, Alan Bergen reached out to me and said, I want to make a formal apology. Mm-hmm. Everything that I spoke about in terms of conversion therapy at BYU, it wasn't true. It was based on our very best efforts of holding up our religious tradition, but it wasn't science-based. He now has two sons and a grandson who identify on the spectrum, identify as gay. And he essentially made it to this intersection that so many of us have become familiar with and realized that he hurt and damaged a lot of people's lives. And the aversion therapy at BYU literally cost people their lives. And Alan did his very best to give a heartfelt, and there's no way to apologize for suicide. There is no adequate and proper way of apologizing for some people living lives of complete celibacy and fidelity to God when that wasn't completely necessary. There's no way to apologize to a wife who found out after 35 years her husband was a closeted homosexual who had been cheating on her in order to extinguish the flames, that this was a process that had been created by a religious institution, essentially saying that if you just try hard enough to till your knuckles bleed, you will indeed succeed. All of this rhetoric that was created, that that just spewed from BYU and the basement of the Smith Family Living Center was a product of Bergen and Bird. And so not only did On the Record expose a lot of that messaging, but it also brought somebody like an Alan Bergen out to apologize formally. And the church did push back on that. As soon as it hit, I did get an email back from one of the secretaries that I know of an apostle who said that this particular apostle is aware of On the Record. I did have someone reach out asking specifically if Alan Bergen, if I actually had contact or if this was just something that was emailed to me arbitrarily. And then I published the apology based on that. I even had Carolyn Pearson.
It was a written apology. Is that what you're saying? He didn't come on your program. It was a written.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a written apology that he wanted his name signed to that could be distributed. That was really important to Alan to make sure that there was a written record that everyone knew that he for sure, this was from Alan. So yeah, Carolyn Pearson phoned me and said, is this really the case? Because if it is, it's monumental. This is something that we've all waited for. The church's behind the closed door response was, well, Alan Bergen is getting old. His memory's probably failing, and that's what we can expect. Wow. What we get from the organization.
Yeah, that's really. And how was that apology received by the community?
It's a mixed message for sure. As you can imagine, all the things that I just went through, how do you undo suicide? How do you undo mixed orientation marriages? How do you undo? I mean, I know a gentleman who is 83 years old and has remained completely celibate his whole life. He identifies as gay. He's still ultra religious and believes that the church is completely true. And because of that, he'll be fixed in the end. How do you tell someone like that, that everything that he's still these 80 plus years later believing in was created by a man who apologized for saying, this was a test. This was something that we tried and it didn't work. And it was our best guess, but it was not science-based. So there's that aspect of the community that had a really difficult time trying to understand how to process that apology. There were some people who accepted the apologies for what it was. And it's the Maya Angelou approach. When we know better, we do better. And all these years later, for Alan Bergen and his wife and his children, they knew better because they learned something. And I mean, isn't that the great Mormon message? Do what is right, let the consequence follow. For the Bergens, all these years later, they know what was right. And it should have happened 30 years ago. It shouldn't have happened in May of 2019, right, or 20. It should have happened as soon as one or two or three of his gay children came out, and then he realized I made some mistakes. But Mormonism is a funny monster when we start talking about apology and whether or not there is, in Dallin Oaks' words, a necessity for apology or even a place for apology, even if it's warranted, he says. But so, yeah, the really just two polar opposite sides of the community, some very forgiving, some will accept an apology, but how does that apology fix something? And I hope that the fix is that more apologies come down the road, and that more importantly than that, we change the rhetoric and we change the tradition, because the trajectory right now, I see the two greatest factors for people leaving the church is one, historical issues, and two, LGBTQ, the treatment of LGBTQ people within our society. And as the church continues to fail at both of those, the sounds that they hear are no longer congregations full of hymn singers, but footsteps walking out of those doors never to return again. And that's devastating for a faith tradition.
Yeah. A few thoughts as you were talking. You know, 20 plus years ago, when I was asked to work with my first mixed orientation couple as a greenie therapist, and I was a contractor for LDS Family Services, there was a book that was given to me by Bird, by the person that you mentioned, and that was the materials I was supposed to go through and figure out how to do my treatment plan. And even at the time, not knowing much, I could see a lot of things problematic with it. And I was really confused as a therapist. Like, I don't know that this is really what we're supposed to be doing. And then also a lot of my clients at that time were involved in the Evergreen organization, which now no longer exists, right? Is that correct? I don't think it exists.
Hallelujah. It it just morphed into North Star.
Yeah.
North Star inherited the Evergreen database essentially, but so we had general authorities that were sitting on the Evergreen board, and their keynote speakers were always a Ballard, a Pace, a Featherstone, an Oaks. So it wasn't that the church had kept an arm's length distance from Evergreen. They were completely entrenched in it. Now on the North Star side of it, they're not as close bedfellows, but there is still plenty of connection there.
Well, and that's what's always frustrating, is that the church can say, no, these organizations are not affiliated officially with the church, and yet they either get a lot of direct support and allyship or indirect support. I feel the same way about Fight the New
Divide. Isn't that a funny thing about Mormonism? And you'll see this as well, and Sam Young sees this, and the Richard Oslers who spend time in this space see this, but unless you're a card-carrying member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, your message holds no weight. And this is particular to your situation. When you're in, you're believable. When you're out, you are unbelievable. And this is a problem in Mormonism, because it's the very reason that you're talking about Byrd's books. And I actually just picked up, and we'll talk about this a little later, but I have now a box of Byrd's books that are mint copies that were just passed over to me. This was their non-scientific approach with these religious blinders on, mm-hmm. of solving this issue that wasn't science-based, but because they were card-carrying members of the church, were to believe them and were to believe that they are directed by either a mythical spirit, the Holy Spirit, or just their goodness, because a Latter-day Saint wouldn't lead us astray. A priesthood leader wouldn't lead us astray. So therefore, we will listen to their message as if it's clinical science. And that's the problem. And on both sides of this, you get Dean Byrd who produced manuals, and Bergens who produced manuals and documents like this that negatively impact people. And then you also get these members within the church who won't listen to anyone outside of the circle, because you're not one of them. Even though people outside of the circle are screaming to you their real lived experiences and scientific data, it's mind-boggling to me.
So let's move into then kind of your experience with me then. So how do you find out about the council? And I think right away, you know, I was saying the three things that I was being, in a sense, accused of was being vocal and public in my opposition to church leaders, and the three kind of areas that they refer to my vocality about. Vocality, is that a word? I'm not sure. But it was my stances on masturbation, my stances on treating pornography, and my stances on same-sex marriage, which is how they claimed that term. I think the better term now is same gender marriage, but you can talk to me a little bit about that.
Sure. So this is an interesting intersection, because in this space, in terms of LGBTQ messaging and understanding and working in this space, we having podcasts or working with groups like Encircle that are out there in the trenches, working one-on-one, hand-in-hand with the LGBTQ community. One of our greatest strengths and assets are the mental health professionals. We usually scoop people out of their closets. They come out usually falling, stumbling, and they need a soft landing. And that's really what Latter-day Stories was created to be, is a soft landing as people fall out of their comfortable and unforgiving spaces. And from there, we have to get them into healthy resources. So I mean, we clearly were familiar with your work and with the work of other therapists, Flourish and Symmetry, and even the Mormon Mental Health Association. These are all resources that we use to direct people. I'm not a licensed therapist. Many of us aren't licensed therapists. We're licensed empathizers. We have PhDs in understanding what it's like to live in closets and feel those feelings of shame. So when the rain starts falling and we start seeing what's happening to one of our own, it's time to rally together. And as your story starts making waves, our queer community starts paying attention, knowing that, let's just speak about masturbation for a second. There are two types of humans, one that has masturbated and one that hasn't masturbated yet. And the church is completely comfortable in believing that there are three types. Interestingly, that a religion of such stark binary we know for sure that there are people impacted by that particular topic that is the majority of our clientele, the majority of our audience. So when we start speaking of shameful experiences, of excommunication, of interviews, of false teachings, that's in the church's methodology in trying to overcome who and what we are, those are all dog whistles for the gay community, the queer community. And so obviously as your story was coming up, our audience was all over it. Mm-hmm. We rally to support those who support us. Mm-hmm. And for sure, Natasha has always been there, not only as a health professional, but as just a really great human who herself is personally impacted by this topic. And again, Maya Angelou, when you know better, you do better. And we all have room to grow in this space. And so we were there to rally for you. And my audience was 100% interested in it. Likewise, John and I with the Mormon, John Jalin and the Mormon Stories podcast are great friends as well. And we collaborate together on multiple projects in order to help bring some light into the darkest corners of topics like this, because it's important that and our audiences blend, but also much of my audience is still very much Mormon, there are a number of Latter-day Saints who are in this space because they have children who come out, but yet they still want to hold tight to the traditions of their faith. And that's understandable as well. But interestingly enough, those were some of our loudest voices in the Latter-day Stories community. Those parents who saw the overwhelming increase and stability of their children after they were able to free themselves of these shackles of shame that were put on them by religion and an uninformed religious leader. So again, it meant a lot to us that we were there to support you, because that support was there to boost us as well. So that's really why I jumped in.
Yeah, no, thank you. And that's a great honor for you to say any of those things. I really appreciate one of my favorite places to go and present almost yearly is Affirmation, you know, and I'm a mama dragon, you know, and have had my own personal journey with a kiddo of mine as far as understanding, you know, gender binary and bisexuality and things like that, you know, I knew professionally, but it's a whole different thing to know those kinds of things more in your personal life. So it is a cause obviously dear to my heart, but was dear to my heart before I even knew anything about my child. So just as a professional. So moving on, why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience going to Wichita, and what did you experience and what did you see and how did, you know, as you were filming and things like that, what was your audience kind of, how were they reacting and just kind of your Wichita experience versus mine? How about that?
Yeah. Miss Lincoln, how was the rest of the play?
Yeah.
That was your Wichita experience. Yeah. My Wichita, I knew I was in for something strange heading into Wichita when I landed in Wichita, but all of my equipment to do the podcast and the broadcast landed in St. Louis.
I heard about that. I'm so sorry. That's like the worst case scenario. That's worse than like your lipstick bag landing in St. Louis. At least for
me. I know.
Me.
Isn't that the worst? Yeah. It was unbelievable, because I was the guy. I was the guy standing at the baggage carousel waiting, thinking that the little escalator thing would start up again and a bag would pop over the top and fall into my hands, and it never happened.
When did you get there, on Saturday or Sunday?
I got there on Sunday.
Oh,
and they
wow.
told me that
hours before then. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, we landed at 1 and we were planning on setting up. The live broadcast started at 6:45, but I was planning on setting up around 5 o'clock. So that was the plan, and it didn't happen. All of my audio equipment, my camera filters, just all the things that I use were in St. Louis. And they said, well, fortunately, we will have all your stuff here tomorrow at noon. And I said, well, that's wonderful, because I'll be here at 1 to fly back out. So I'll pick it back up and we'll figure out how we're going to make this work. So
did you get your stuff back? Did you get your stuff back eventually?
Yeah, I did. I did show up, and there it was. And they had a dozen different excuses that none of them have panned out yet. So they're still trying to figure out what happened to my bag. But I mean, thankfully, so just a couple shout outs to the Martins, Clint and Jenny, over the top, wonderful. If you watch the Latter-day Stories broadcast of Natasha's tribunal, it was because of Clint and Jenny. Clint, before we even stopped at your house, Natasha, he said, nope, let's go to Best Buy, Guitar Center. Where do you need to go to find this equipment? And we're going to put this together. And so they rented a car. We jumped into it. And we went all over Kansas picking up the equipment that we needed to at least just skeleton put this thing together. And it was terrible because the listeners don't get to see that side of what's happening. But I've got equipment that is literally duct taped together in order to try to make this podcast work. And we're having audio feedback and things not working just because this is all brand new equipment that I've never worked with before that we're trying to get interesting systems to work together on. So that was the interesting part of getting that ready and set up. But once we got set up, the idea behind the broadcast, I was also in charge of the vigil that was happening that evening and getting the speakers lined. So we had a really great program prepared, which included some of your witnesses and great speakers like Sam Young and Paul Schiff. And we can just talk about all the wonderful people that were surrounding this whole event. But this is all set up, ready to go. And we're just kind of like mingling. I didn't have really a great opportunity to mingle with too many people prior to the event, but I did have some online conversations with some of the people as we set up. I got the vigil set up and that speaker list put together. And then just there under the pavilion, I just started mixing and mingling with a few people and just started the general welcome to the podcast. And instantly our feed blew up, which was just phenomenal to see. Just heartbreaking because I'm like, I don't even know how this is sounding. And obviously like people were complaining because the audio is fuzzy and I'm making adjustments and I'm feeling terrible. I don't want to lose people. That's why I'm feeling terrible because right out of the gate, we start out with 800 people who are watching the live stream. So this is obviously an event that people are interested in and they're paying attention to. And I want to, just as someone who runs a podcast, I want to make sure it's clean and smooth, that everything works perfectly. That's my nature. And any hiccup or bump is always frustrating. So I'm concerned that people aren't getting the experience that they deserve. And we're whittling through that. But fortunately, the audience just stuck with it. And throughout the night, we just had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I mean, 500, 600, 700 people stayed tuned to this story. Because thanks to Natasha, it becomes riveting. If you want good drama, like, throw Natasha in the mix because we have our speakers. Yeah, and you can take, this is your opportunity for adulation. We have the speakers lined up. We have the sunset, there's a rainbow flag and there's the stake center in the background. And then all of a sudden here comes Natasha out. I think we're interviewing Sam Young at the time, Sam. And then that's when you're walking into the council or beginning the bathroom banter of the council experience. And it was interesting just to watch as this starts unfolding and a little uneasiness starts happening in the crowd because it isn't going as normally as one of these membership councils usually happen. And I'm trying to keep the audience up to date. Interestingly enough, we have people who are watching this live feed who are completely oblivious to how Mormon excommunications work. Mm-hmm. So we're giving them just a play-by-play as to what to expect, how the councils work, which I think the audience is learning and understanding from. And then we're talking about the intricacies and oddness of your experience. Why isn't the full council here? Why aren't her witnesses able to run in there and have the time necessary to plead their case? Why is everyone still standing outside of the stake center door? I mean, there were a lot of these questions that we, just looking from the outside, we're trying to understand and dissect from hundreds of feet away. But again, we just continue to hold the vigil and allow people to share their messages of hope and grief and pain and their experiences, especially for people like John DeLynn and Sam Young who had walked this path and been through that before. So overall, the feeling, the mood of the event was really positive, and people were there to honor and support someone that made an impact and a difference in their lives. But interestingly, the other part of this conversation was not the not the loss of Natasha's membership, but the loss of the professional clinical opinion and best practices of the church. That this wasn't just a membership council about Natasha losing her membership. This was a membership council wherein family services and Mormon-related wards and branches and stakes would be losing this wealth of knowledge and this resource. And I thought that was an interesting experience, that people were mourning the fact that the church was losing something, not that Natasha was losing something from the church. And I have to agree with them. Like that made a lot of sense, that here was not only just Natasha, but just the Ruth, these other people are part of the Mormon Mental Health Association who are there to support you, other clinicians, other psychiatrists, other therapists who are there in their official capacity saying, the loss here is the church. The church is losing its very best by doing stuff like this. And you can speak to the binders full of testimonials that were delivered to President Daley. It was, as you held them up, it was a testament that all is not well in Zion if this is the direction that you want to take.
Well, not to mention too, the professional letter that was written by all, you know, active LDS professionals that we now have over 800 signatures to. So the signatures have continued to come in even after Sunday's event. So, and that's a mix, you know, it's a mix of signatures, LDS and Mormon therapists, non-LDS therapists, you know, Utah therapists, a lot of people who work with the Mormon clientele, you know, nationwide. So yeah, really, really, really interesting for sure.
And I know there's more to that too, because I've received personal messages while I was doing the vigil of people saying I wasn't able to get to the email portion of email this to President Daley, but here's what I would have emailed. Please read this if you get a stall in the broadcast. Like if you need time, like here are my words. And I received two from therapists and one from a mother whose child experienced a faith transition and a sexual orientation journey. And it was because of the Mormon Mental Health Association that they were able to make strides there. So there were more than just those thousands that you were able to accumulate as well, which was exciting.
And just so people know, I mean, I've needed a week to kind of just recover. This is my week where I'm kind of starting to like actually leave my house. But I do plan on having kind of a new email where we don't, if people feel like they still want to write in a story or anything like that, and they feel like they missed that opportunity, we will be continuing to find a way to take those stories. So I don't have all the information to that yet, but just know that all of that will be made available, that I see this kind of as an ongoing project at this point, because I think these, like you just talked about with your podcast, is such an important story to tell, you know.
Yeah, and what a brilliant resource to fall back on. And as the church finally emerges out of their darkness of in this space, other clinicians, other church leaders can reflect on that and say, this is where we made a mistake, and lean into those thousands of voices. I think that'd be a wonderful repository.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you know, you've mentioned several times Maya Angelou's comment of when we know better, we do better. And I think that's been my frustration with the church and its leaders, because I do feel like the information is there. I think that I don't really understand why they can claim that they don't know better. I feel like at this point, you know, they do, with all of the written testimony way before this incident happened with me, right? I mean, lots of Papa and Mama Dragons have talked to the apostles. There's been lots of data available for decades on the risks of non-affirming communities to LGBT, especially T folks. So that's what I think is especially hard for me. And when I get a little feisty and say naughty words, I'm like, how can you not do better? Because I think you do know better, right? So do you want to speak to that at all?
I do. I want to help answer your question with what I led into. Clearly the church knows better. Why aren't they doing better? This is an authoritative foundational issue with the church. If they're wrong on this topic, what else are they wrong on? and the current leaders of the church have invested everything. And I only scratched the surface with what Dallin Oaks has done in this space, but I haven't talked about the 1985 memorandum. I haven't talked about the principles to govern. I haven't talked about the book Homosexuality. I haven't talked about the Catholic-Mormon partnership. I haven't talked about Prop 8 or 13. I haven't talked about Utah's Amendment 3. These are all issues that the church hitched their wagon to in the name of God and with apostolic witness that this is exactly the mind and will of God in this space, that turned out to be completely unsubstantiated. Oaks has went to the extent to say, if you're the parents of a gay child, don't invite your child over. Don't treat them as lengthy house guests. Don't take them into public. If your child identifies as queer, ensure and do all that you can do to ensure that they don't have a position of trust with children or work in schools. He has said that it's important to exclude certain people from society. We have so much of this tradition and rhetoric that's come from 50 North, particularly from Dallin Oaks. And if you were to turn around and say, have a June 7th, 1978 moment where the church reversed its policy on Blacks in the priesthood, if you were to say, forget everything we said about this topic, tomorrow is a new day in terms of the LGBTQ discussion, what standing would the current first presidency have when it comes to education and authority on social topics and social topics that impact a large swath of Mormonism? It's an authority issue. So do they know better? Of course they know better. I've had conversations with general authorities who know better. I know these general authorities who have gay relatives. They know better. Why aren't they doing it? Because it jeopardizes their position. It jeopardizes their authority. Someone once said that's the patriarchal prick side of this whole experience. And I get it. It's because, and when you bring up this idea of the name calling, I mean, miracle forgiveness alone used words like contagion and sin against nature, a crime against nature, a sin akin to murder, bestiality, pervert. These are all descriptors that were used to describe people. Yeah, these are descriptors used to describe my mom, my dad, my daughter. And when a mom and a dad and a son and a brother look to their religious tradition and say, they are none of the things that the church is telling me they are, that's where that dissonance starts to grow. And that real lived experience weighs and has so much more strength than the rhetoric that comes from 50 North. And as that continues to happen, the church hemorrhages its members. This isn't rocket science. This is a clear understanding that when we're good people and we treat people as they should be treated, we will grow. And our community is growing. I see another religious community that's not growing. And it should be a testament to the truth and the validity of this message, which is Mormonism against Mormonism, I suppose.
Well, maybe you're the wrong person to speak to about this because I'm not sure you're a historian per se, but we have had many policy changes and doctrinal understanding changes in the past. And I haven't seen those moments, have many people leave the church. So even when the authorities in those times did change and did change course, people stayed, as far as I know, for the most part. So it seems kind of weird to me when we have this history of the ability to change, whether it was polygamy or, race or feminine issues, which still haven't completely changed. But why, it just doesn't seem like, the Community of Christ had that issue. The Community of Christ had the issue where they ordained women and accepted gay leaders in the church at a time when it was kind of like socially, they were kind of ahead of the game in social justice instead of behind the game. So they did have a lot of people leave their community because of those two issues, from my limited understanding of the Community of Christ. But I don't know that we've had that experience. Do you have anything to say to that? And you can just say pass. I don't know much about that. And I'll ask somebody else.
No, there are historical markers in the church that cause people to flood the exit doors in Mormonism. November 5th, 2015, when the policy of exclusion was made manifest secretly, then leaked to the ex-Mormon community, and then it made the headlines of every major newspaper. There were a flood of people in particular who gathered at Temple Square in downtown Salt Lake, and they filed their formal resignations. I think about 2,000 formal resignations came that evening. I think it was the 7th of November, or the 8th of November in 2015. A little foreword, President Nelson spoke at BYU in January of 2016, reaffirming that the November 2015 policy was revelation from God. And that caused a great amount of dissonance. And from there, a number of people resigned their membership. But even prior to that, the Great Awakening in 2008, 2009-ish, around the Prop 8 California movement, 13, those were all movements where large swaths of Latter-day Saints resigned their membership based on the church's inability to grasp this topic. But to your question, I'm not familiar with members, people who are joining the church or staying in the church because of the church's favorable treatment of the LGBTQ community.
But I guess I'm asking more, right? It's like yeah, when they act on the wrong side of social justice, people flock. But when they've acted on the right side of social justice, I haven't seen that flocking. That's, I guess, what I was getting at.
Yeah, and I would see the fringe movements, like the Des Knox and the Orthodox Mormons holding on to those messages. I mean, you and I both spend a lot of time in social media space, so we see that aspect of the community made manifest in different posts. So there's a segment of that community that's made stronger, and their orthodox and rigid conservative views are solidified when the church makes hard right stances on certain topics. But I just can't, no, there's nothing that comes to mind that screams jump in membership or a reactivity based on something that has been said that's hard lined from the church. Always, I agree with you, always quite the opposite.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, finish up your experience in Wichita. Like, just what do you want to say about how your experience was, what you noticed, what questions you had, or call me.
Yeah, I think
anything you want to call me out, whatever you want to do.
Quit punching my friend Clint. He did a lot to make sure that people were able to watch your tribunal, and then you just go and punch him.
It was consensual, but I made him bleed. He was like, just hit me. At first I thought he was meaning a, like, high five. He's like, no, like, punch my hands. I'm like, really? Okay.
And to be fair to Natasha, he already had a pre-existing condition. So
yes,
it wasn't just your brute strength.
Yeah. Although that would have been kind of cool to think about that I had that kind of strength.
So here, let me dissect this the best way that I am able to. And I wanted to look at your membership council from not the only the lens of some disfranchised former gay Latter-day Saint who runs a podcast. I really wanted to look at your experience based on, or look at it through the lens of an everyday Latter-day Saint who would fall on my live feed and try to understand what was happening. And looking through that lens, I remember Kyle of 6 years ago, who was the young men's president of his ward, who was doing his very best to teach 18, 16-year-olds that they should serve a mission, get married in the church, and live all the commandments righteously. And what I would have seen and through that lens, watching your excommunication tribunal, would have been 100 or so people gathered together under a pavilion who each were worthy of excommunication themselves, who were bitter apostates. And I maybe played into this a little bit because I did have a shirt on that said lazy learner. That's what I would have gotten being a Latter-day Saint looking at this. And I think that's the message that the church has created for Latter-day Saints to believe in, the faith supportive narratives that have been written in newspapers, the Deseret News, KSL, these news sources that are favorable to the church's message. The lens that we see that through is that this is one apostate rallying a group of apostates together, And when birds of a feather flock together, this is what you get. And that's what I fully expected the Latter-day Saint community to see. And when I got there, and when I'm able to rub shoulders with the people who are in that meeting, I see a completely different side. I see a side that I wouldn't have been able to see in 6 year ago, Kyle's experience. I see former bishops who have been excommunicated because they believe that the individual dignity of that person was worth more than a right to be interviewed for a temple recommend or a birthday interview. I see and rub shoulders with someone who is excommunicated for giving a TED talk about treating LGBTQ people as normal human beings who make positive contributions to our society. I rub shoulders with parents of gay children who say, our daughter was made better because she left this organization and remained intact and healthy and whole in terms of her personal worth. I meet people who say, I'm here because I'm a therapist and a clinician who believes that there is no such thing as chewed gum, that we all have value and worth. I meet people who say, I'm here because we just wanted to share our experience and we did it via TikTok. And because of that, we are now being excommunicated or facing excommunication. And our very best remedy was to regain and hold our own power and resign from an organization that clearly didn't want us there. I meet people who are active Latter-day Saints, who are holding temple recommends of their own, who are both nuanced and also entrenched in their faith, who say, we have to do better than this, and that this is a blind spot for the church. I meet a collection of people that shouldn't have been all together under one roof and under a narrative that has been painted regarding this space shouldn't have coexisted, but it existed well and perfectly. They were hugging each other. They were meeting new friends. I mean, I think of Emma Harris, the poem that she wrote. I meet her mom, Sandra, and her mom says, I wish for sometime in this vigil tonight that the words of my daughter can be shared. When did we as a society get to the point where we're throwing out real lived experiences in science in the name of religion? And her daughter just pens this perfectly poignant poem, just a 1 minute experience that encapsulates everything that we're there for. And her mom is an active Latter-day Saint. Those aren't the people that Mormonism painted to be under a canopy supporting someone who they had already preconceived and deemed as an apostate. And that's where Mormonism is getting this message wrong. Mormonism is convinced that people who leave the church are all of those things. Likewise, people who identify somewhere along the LGBTQ spectrum will never find happiness or spiritual experiences or goodness on this side of the aisle. And your experience, your tribunal, and the people who met there during that vigil, and my real lived experience prove the church's narrative to be untrue. And how many more Natashas, how many more Kyles, how many more Harrises, how many more Sam Youngs, John DeLynns will it take before the church realizes that our stories are valid and our experiences are writing the chapters in these books? Far too many, I believe.
Yeah. No, I thought that too. And that was what was interesting too for me, as I got so many of the letters coming in, which I still haven't had time to read them all, but the letters of support came from a wide variety, you know, of people. And about like 98% of them were written very respectfully. You know, I mean, some of them were, I would say maybe 2% were written maybe from, I wouldn't even say disrespectfully, but angry tone, you know, like, how dare you do this, et cetera. But 97% of the letters were written in a very respectful, like, you need to understand our story, and whether we're post-Mormon or active Mormon or somewhere in between, this is what we'd like to share. And they were very equally dispersed, you know, as far as what was coming in. So that was quite moving to see that this is an issue, you know, sexual health and mental health and mixed faith marriages and supporting, you know, being a parent of an LGBTQ plus child, all of those things affect all of us, right? Regardless of where we land in Mormonism. And so I think that's why it was a topic that garnered such wide support, or, you know, maybe left a lot of people feeling confused, or that cognitive dissonance again, that is hard when you can't fall completely on one side or another, you know, in regards to some of these issues. So thank you for that.
Yeah, I agree. Watching the social media side of it, as the New York Post, MSN, local news, the Salt Lake Tribune, Deseret News, were publishing articles, I was reading the comments that were being made. And the interesting part was, I can't recall the number, but it was significant of posts that had something to do with, or something along the lines of, I'm a Latter-day Saint, but, like, I'm a Latter-day Saint, but this is really weird. I'm a Latter-day Saint, but we shouldn't be doing this. I'm a Latter-day Saint, but we should be paying attention to these clinicians. I'm a Latter-day Saint, but, and that dissonance is not healthy. But people were recognizing it. So I was moved by the number of active card-carrying Latter-day Saints who are out there supporting the Natasha Helfers as well.
Yeah. Well, so what's it been like as you went home and kind of had some time to decompress, regain your luggage, and maybe have some conversations with people here, you know, in your own community, et cetera?
Sure. Yeah, we discussed it. Unfortunately, we have a few small gatherings that are happening. And we just had this discussion again last night in an event called Allies and Appetizers, which is a little Zoom event that we have that puts this topic in the face of potential or future allies, people who are trying to better understand this space, the LGBTQ space. And we had this discussion about your experience in Kansas and about a lot of the things that we discussed today. And it has been really beneficial to not only have those in-person discussions, but even online, the private messages, people reaching out, just venting and also wanting to have space to share their feelings. And it's been a good opportunity to have this discussion. And again, my intention, not only professionally or on the podcast or even in this discussion tonight, isn't to berate or belittle the church. But again, it comes back to this: do what is right, let the consequence follow. And if we are going to make positive steps forward in this space, we must do better. And I think that's been the general message, because as a community, we're not going to wait for the church to catch up. We don't have time and we don't have the energy to wait for the church to get on board with our messaging, because we have people in our community that have suicidal ideation, that have these issues of shame and self-worth, and depression is real. And as a community, if our faith community and our church isn't there to rally and support the troops, then we have to create our own version, and we have to go out there and do the dirty work ourselves. And those are the messages that I'm receiving in the real world. People who are saying, "How can I help? Like, how can I help and not become a Natasha Helfer?" And the reality is this: sometimes this space is dirty, and that you will leave it with your hands messy and your pants and boots are muddy. But I mean, to use Mormonism against Mormonism, yeah, the work is difficult and tough and tiring, and the pay is awful, but the rewards are eternal. Mm-hmm. And when I see families who rise above this and they embrace each other again as mixed faith families, mixed orientation families, or queer families who are able to love unconditionally again, I say the mud was worth it. And these real world discussions are making a positive difference in this space. So it's been enjoyable. Going to Kansas was a super positive experience. And your excommunication isn't the first one I've attended. I've been to a number of them. I kind of become a roadie. When they happen, I want to be in that mix, because it exposes an archaic and old tradition that shouldn't happen. And the more we shine light on this topic of excommunication and how harmful and hurtful it is, maybe that changes, or maybe the President Daley's out there realize that their clandestine methodology isn't helpful to the good name of the church, the very reason why they think you're there, or to the overall growth of that society. Personally, that's what I believe.
Yeah. No, that's beautifully said. This On the Record document that you mentioned earlier, is that, where can we find that? Is that readily available? Is that on a website?
The easiest way to find it is by going to the website, LatterGayStories.org/record, RECORD, LatterGayStories.org/record. And I think I need to check, but I know we just surpassed our 20,000th download of the On the Record. Mm-hmm. So it definitely has some legs, and it's been a fun project that I call a living document. So I continue to add to it, but you can download it in PDF form, and then you can just click through. There are a year's worth of study and great information that is contained there in On the Record. And likewise, like if someone is interested in the podcast as well, it's Latter Gay Stories. Is our LatterGayStories.org is the main website, but we're on all the social media channels, really prevalent on Facebook. That's where we spend a lot of our time. We have video and audio podcasts. So I'm kind of the geek that really enjoys seeing human interaction and being there with the guests. So yeah. I'm a firm believer in those in-person experiences. So all of our podcast episodes do have the video version with them. Mm-hmm. But if you're just an audio junkie, you can catch us everywhere you find your favorite podcasts. We're on Stitcher and iHeartRadio and Apple and Google and all those great places. But I would definitely invite you to come join our Facebook community. There are many allies there who have no children that identify in the spectrum, but they're there because they want to learn something and they want to interact with the stories. And many of the Latter-day Saints who join our community are there because of the clarion call from M. Russell Ballard, who says we must do better to listen to and understand the experiences of the LGBTQ community. As a church, we're not doing a good job at it. His words, not mine. And where are you going to find it? Well, you're going to get a soft focused version, a really watered down version from the church, but there are other places out there to get the real candid stories. And I hope that Latter-day Stories is a place where you can find that. And we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of stories, both written or in podcast or video form, that help share the stories of the marginalized. And I promise you, they're life-changing and they're heartbreaking and they're beautiful and they're joyful. And they're all those things that, yeah, that we as a society need to embrace.
I love that. I'm guessing you've podcasted about this project On the Record.
I haven't actually, I haven't done a full On the Record podcast. I should
ask you to come on my podcast again and do that.
Yeah, I would love to jump into On the Record because it is fascinating stuff. And there are a lot of players behind the scenes that help, from the Greg Princes to I even spoke with Michael Quinn to produce some of this stuff behind the scenes. There are general authorities who added to On the Record, to the Alan Bergens out there who are making apologies, to the simple stories of those who were directly impacted by this topic and made a contribution to the way the church changed their narrative or the rhetoric on this topic. So I would love to one day sit down with you, Natasha, and go through it with your community and really put this on the record, because for so many Latter-day Saints, they are still in this mindset that the church has only been favorable and kind. But not only do I want to expose the old messaging, but I also want to expose where the church started and where they're at today, because there are some messages of hope there that the church has made some substantial steps forward in some of this space. And I think that is worthy of being talked about and made known. So yeah, LatterGayStories.org/record. You'll be able to download that copy yourself and ingest it before we have our big discussion.
Yeah, no, I definitely will. And I didn't mean to applaud like, oh, you haven't podcasted about it, but I just want to. So I'm glad that you're willing to. So, okay, awesome. So obviously, I'm guessing you're a nonprofit, I'm guessing. So how do people donate or, you know, help your cause?
Yeah, so I actually never jumped into the nonprofit world. I should and I need to, but you still are able to make a donation. It just wouldn't be fully tax exempt. And that's something that I will jump into. I really started the Latter-day Stories as a labor of love. I have been super fortunate in my professional life to be able to have the time and the means to be able to push a podcast forward. I've also recognized the donations do two things. One, it's able to extend our reach further into the LGBTQ LDS community, that it has been able to provide us the opportunity to build bigger and stronger bridges between those two communities. But the other side of investing or making donations into a podcast like mine that I didn't ever realize existed was the personal investment. When someone felt like making an investment into a project like Latter-day Stories would provide them an opportunity at a return where they felt like they were part of the project because they financially supported it, I didn't realize how powerful that was. And I come to that realization that allowing people the opportunity to invest into the podcast, into what we were doing, gave them the ability to feel connected. And there are a number of things. So I want to answer your question first. We are Venmo friendly. You can Venmo us at Latter-day Stories. We also have a donate tab on the Latter-day Stories website at lattergaystories.org. You can click on the donate tab and make a one-time or a monthly donation to the podcast. And I just want to thank our many monthly donors who make a positive impact via financially to the podcast. And there are a number of programs that we do within the podcast. We have what we call our Trash the Stash, Throw It Away Thursday, where hundreds of our listeners flock the Deseret Industries, the Savers, Grandma's bookshelf, and we rid the shelves of copies of Miracle of Forgiveness. And our Trash the Stash, I need to double check, but we do it every Thursday, but our tally as of yesterday was 1,026 for the year, 1,026 copies of the Miracle of Forgiveness that have been trashed or removed off of the shelves in Mormonism.
That's
funny. Again, just helping this positive message. But we also coming up for the Color of the Campus, which is BYU's big event, not necessarily BYU, it's the event that happens on the BYU campus, the recent lighting of the Y at the BYU campus was part of the Color of the Campus event. But thanks to a number of generous donors, I was able to put together 2,000 rainbow and trans-colored umbrellas that will be distributed to the next Color of the Campus in Hawaii, Idaho, and Utah campuses of the CES schools for the next Color of the Campus. That was all made possible by the donations that come into the Latter-day Stories podcast. In addition, I travel all over the country interviewing really interesting humans with remarkably normal stories. Mm-hmm. And it also funded the trip to head to Kansas and to lose all of my equipment. It was because of generous donors who were able to make that possible that allow me to continue from my little piece of America sharing this message that I think is so vitally important.
Yeah. And before anybody kind of, you know, listening who's LDS gets upset about the Miracle of Forgiveness project, I just want to point out that Deseret Book no longer publishes it or holds it in their store. So this is kind of one of those ways that the church functions, is that they kind of quietly get rid of things that have bad information in it without really announcing, hey, by the way, all of you who read this book, we publicly apologize that there were some things that were probably not very healthy for you to read, and please get rid of them and don't, you know, donate them to the bookstores. So
yeah,
in
true Mormon fashion, they pull it and they quit producing it. The Miracle of Forgiveness was printed 1.7 million times. So there are plenty of copies out there that are floating around, plus the digital version. But the church, yes, they pulled it, but they didn't have their Bruce R. McConkie moment where they said, forget everything that was in it. They just pulled it off the shelves and they wanted it to quietly disappear on its own. But we are just helping that move forward a little quicker. And if an unsuspecting young queer kid doesn't have to read chapter 6 of the Miracle of Forgiveness because a well-meaning Latter-day Saint thought that was the doctrine, then I hope that our over 1,000 copy campaign works, if not for anyone but that one queer kid who doesn't have to feel like they are a sinner similar to a murderer or all of the descriptors that were used in that book. And just one other little comment. Spencer W. Kimball's biographer also said Spencer W. Kimball himself wasn't proud of the Miracle of Forgiveness and thought the tone was too harsh. So even the author should have pulled that book and felt like it was too rigid.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Kyle, you've been like just a flow of amazing information. I very much appreciate your support personally. It was very meaningful that you would come and be part of that event with me. I hope that we get to know each other better and more personally since we're now neighbors here in Utah. And I look forward to having you back on the show to talk about this very important document, because I think whether you agree with me or not, and all the, you know, kind of divisive, unfortunately, kind of traditions that we have that divide us unnecessarily, I think we really do need to take seriously what Kyle is saying. And what I can corroborate is that we do have blood on our hands, and we have people who are suffering right now. So, you know, whether we make progress 20 years from now or 200 years from now, that's great, but that doesn't help the queer kid that Kyle was just talking about today, who is really not finding a place in our faith community and home, which is just a devastating space to be in when you don't know how to fit in amongst your loved ones. And especially when you're a minor, you know, it's not like a 12-year-old can say, well, I'm not going to be here anymore. This isn't a healthy place for me. You know, they don't have the developmental maturity or resources or abilities to find healthier spaces. We as the adults need to demand this change that is having such a negative impact on so many of our members and loved ones. And Kyle, you're doing great work. So I'm just super impressed with your own personal story and kind of how you've used that, you know, in an advocacy way to help your own community. And you definitely have allies like me and many others who want to help.
Yeah, thank you, Natasha. And it does take people like you. We're not in the temple building business. We're not in the flower planting business. We're in triage. And there are real people out there who need our help. And so many who just, and by need your help, they just want to know that they're loved, just loved. And they just want to know that if they come out, you'll still talk to them again, and that you'll still hug them at family reunions, and that you'll still include them in your lagoon trip. That is as simple as it can be for so many in this community. And it is triage. When they lose that sense of community, we start losing them from our community. And I don't want to see that happen. I will work tirelessly and continue to offer what little I have if it saves just that one. That is the meaning of the 90 and 9.
That's right. Amen. Well, thank you, Kyle, for being on the show. Again, if you're wanting to support Kyle's work, visit LatterGayStories.org. If you're wanting to support this podcast, obviously I have a donation button as well on Mormon Sex Info. And we have just really appreciated your attendance and audienceship to our program, and help us spread the word. Help us spread the word that this is a really important topic. So until next time, everybody take care. Good night.
We took the long road home, turned minutes into miles, and as the evening traveled on, the sunset bathed your smile. We stopped beneath the desert stars, wrapped in each other's arms. Was as simple as I love you, an ordinary, extraordinary truth.
It's been a long road here, a trail with tears, pain and sorrow too.
But through every storm, like lovers do. And if sometimes we fell apart, we always came words as simple as I love you. Ordinary, extraordinary,
people say
love is blind and forever is too long. But I see your eyes in every sunrise. Can't imagine life alone. Let's take till we're gone. Won't you by my side till the day I die and into the beyond. It's as simple as our love is. That's how I wanna go. Extraordinary, it's nothing ordinary love. Ordinary,
ordinary.
No, it's extraordinary.